You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. Interstate Batteries offers a wide variety of batteries for your everyday needs. Stop into one of their thousands of retail locations and talk with a battery specialist about batteries for your truck, trail cameras, and even those weird batteries for your rangefinder. Interstate Batteries even offers cell phone repair in certain locations. For more information, visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Mic check, 1, 2. Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles. My name's Dan Johnson. I'm your host. And today we have fellow podcaster Bo Martonic on. And this podcast kind of revolves around what's happening right now. We talk scouting. We talk how his season went. We dive into the podcasting insight that he has been able to acquire over, you know, the course of his podcast as well. And I throw my two cents in. A lot of it is scouting heavy content, along with how and when he feels comfortable on a new property and how long that takes. So it's a really good episode, man. I know that you're going to enjoy it. If you like listening to guys who are fairly successful go out and explain how they do it, you're going to love this episode. Again, heavy in the scouting talk and how that translates to a successful hunting season. So, and if you don't know Bo, he is a big woods style hunter. You know, he's hunting clear cuts, he's hunting heavy terrain, and a little, you know, most different than, I guess, a little bit different than what I do here in the timber ag split in Iowa. And just love talking to guys who can describe what they do and how they do it. And that's why Bo is good at, you know, his podcast, and why he's a guest on this podcast. So really good episode today. We do have a couple of housekeeping things that I need to talk to you guys about. It's almost turkey season, and although the Sportsman's Empire really hasn't been a heavy into the turkey hunting content, we are about to get real heavy in the turkey hunting content with a couple, potentially three. I can't talk about the third one quite yet, but I will talk about the two that are guaranteed here. And so recently we just launched a podcast called the How to Hunt Turkey Podcast. And Paul Campbell from the Ohio Outdoors podcast is the host and producer of that podcast. And I'll tell you this, man, it's really good. He actually works for the NWTF, so he's got a lot of connections with guys within that community, and he's putting out some really good turkey hunting content, turkey themed content, and that's already up. So if you head over to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, sportsmansempire.com, you can check out all the episodes. You can go to iTunes, you can go to Spotify, wherever you download your podcasts, that will be available. And then second on the list, my man Parker McDonald from the Southern Ground Hunting Podcast is launching this Friday. Will be episode number one will be launched. And let's see, Friday, today's the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th. I believe it's the 17th of this month here in February. Parker's going to launch episode number one of the Limb Hanger Turkey Hunting Podcast. Again, pretty much all turkey hunting content on that podcast. And he's going to be interviewing guys, himself included, who are just tore up with turkey hunting. And because of this, like, I'm starting to get fired up about turkey hunting now that these guys are putting out some really good content. And I typically don't get too fired up about turkey hunting. Now, Parker is going to be interviewing guys that he knows in his inner circle that are also really good and really experienced in turkey hunting. So if you're a turkey hunting nut, or if you want to learn more about turkey hunting in general, be sure to check out the Limb Hanger podcast and the How to Hunt Turkey podcast. All of that content, you can listen to them as an individual, or you can go to the Sportsman's Empire Turkey Hunting feed, where all the turkey hunting content will all gather. Those two podcasts including all of the other turkey hunting content that the Sportsman's Empire puts out this spring. So go check out all that content over at the Sportsman's Empire. That's it. I'm going to do some commercials here. Please take some time and listen to them, because they pay my bills and it allows me to keep going here and doing what I'm doing. So first, I'm getting pretty excited about this upcoming fall, because my plans are starting to take shape. I still have to wait on a couple draws if I can hunt Kansas this year. But if I get drawn for Kansas, then I think while I'm down there, I'm also going to try to hunt Oklahoma. And I really think that it's going to be a fun whitetail heavy fall for me. I'm going to try to hunt Oklahoma for whitetails. I'm going to try to hunt Kansas for whitetails, obviously Iowa. And then I might get out west one time for a mule deer hunt. But other than that, I think this year is going to be a heavy whitetail run and gun type of season. And I'm going to be running and gunning with tethered, right? Last year, my whitetail season kind of happened so fast. I was tagged out really quick, so I didn't get to spend as much time in a tethered as I'd like. But I've been practicing. I've been getting more comfortable watching a lot more content that Tethered puts out about their saddle system. And so if you're looking for a saddle, a platform, climbing sticks, or any type of saddle hunting accessory, go check out Tethered's website. Tons of great information there. Next on the list, Wasp Archery. Wasp kills deer dead should be their motto. I absolutely love the people who work for that company. I love the products. I'm very confident with their broadheads, and even in the marginal shots, right? You put pretty much any broadhead through a heart or lungs, it's going to kill. But it's the marginal shots where a really well-designed and well-manufactured broadhead, really shows out, and that's where Wasp steps in, man. You know, the best design, in my opinion, some of the best design, the best material, and still a majority of their heads are made in America. So go check out wasparchery.com, and be sure to enter the discount code NFC20, and that is the discount code for 20% off. Next on the list is Hunt Stand is pretty sweet. I mean, I don't know. You take a product like Hunt Stand out of my hands, and it would just suck to go back old school with it. Looking at paper maps, going online, and being on a desktop computer, trying to, research topo lines and research property boundaries, and going back to a plat book and things like that, it would make it difficult. And so the power of Hunt Stand is huge in my yearly turkey hunting strategy. Not only does it allow me to keep my mind in the game by, constantly being on that app, looking at new access routes, putting out scenarios with hypothetical wind directions, but it gives me the opportunity to document every single thing that I see in the woods, including manage my trail camera pictures and document where I leave my tree stands and my trail cameras, where I see deer. And then on top of that, they have a brand new, what's it called? The Pro Whitetail Platform. And that allows you to, the Pro Whitetail Platform really allows you to take that next step into the obsession that is big bucks and whitetail hunting, and allows you to do things like, man, I'm going long here on this commercial, but it allows you to check out rut timing dates and food plots, agriculture and things like that. So go check out huntstand.com and read up on all the functionality. Really, really happy with the products that they put out. Last but not least, Vortex Optics. Just an amazing company with amazing products and amazing people. They have a VIP warranty. And what that is you break it, you smash it, you destroy your product, you put it in a box, you send it back to Vortex. They will replace it or they will fix it. If they can't fix it, they will replace it for free and then send it back to you. And in my opinion, that's called customer service. They have a brand new tripod coming out, or it's actually already out. You can go get it. Dude, it's badass. And I know maybe for a whitetail hunter, you're not really focused on a tripod at all, but it's perfect for summer scouting or summer spot, put your spotting scope on there. It's perfect for packing in and out on an elk hunt or a mule deer hunt. So go check out their brand new tripod. It's badass. VortexOptics.com. And that's it. Lastly, before we get into today's episode, I do want to mention that in 2023, I really do want to focus on giving back. And that's why I am a member of 2% for Conservation. And I am I'm on the board of directors there. It's because I believe in what this company stands for, or this organization stands for. So if you want to find out more about conservation and how you can give back on your level and get certified, whether you're individually or your own, or your company, fishandwildlife.org, go check it out. All right, 10-minute intro, we're done. Let's get into today's BS session. I'm just going to call it a BS session with fellow podcaster and whitetail nut, Bo Martonic. 3, 2, 1. All right. On the show with me today, Mr. Bo Martonic. Bo, what's up, man?
What's going on, Dan? Long time no talk. Yeah, how have you been?
It's been a while, man. I think you've only been on this show like one other time, maybe. It's been a long, long time ago, though.
Yeah. I think it's been at least 2 or 3 years. If I remember, I don't know. It seems like the years are kind of starting to blur together a little bit in the podcast journeys. We both, are doing that. And it's crazy that, how fast, I guess, time passes with all that.
Yeah. The crazy thing about this is how many episodes have you put out that you know of?
Do you have that 286.
Number? Okay, 286. All right. And I put out multiple shows a week, so I've done over 700. And what is crazy about even, your number, my number, doesn't matter, it's the amount of people that you meet, and at the same time, it's the amount of people that you forget. And it's embarrassing sometimes because I went to, where was I at? It was either the ATA show or it was the Iowa Deer Classic. And a guy came up to me. He's like, "Dan, man, hey, how you doing, man?" I'm just like, "Oh, hey, how you doing?" He's like, "Hey," he starts talking to me about all these things. And I'm just like, "Hey, man, I apologize. What's your name?" He's like, "Oh, you had me on your podcast like 4 years ago." And I was like, "Oh, okay. I don't remember. And I apologize for that." But, it is what it is.
Yeah. And it happens when you're talking to so many different people all the time. And it's not trying to be rude at all. It's not like that person's, a less important. It's just really difficult to keep up with everybody when you're talking to a lot of people at one time.
I can't even keep track of my own kids half the time. So don't be offended if I forget about you.
Yep.
So, how is everything going in the podcast game for you guys?
Good. Yeah. Everything's going well. I've been doing it now for going on 5 years. Coming up here in July will be 5 years and almost 1 year of doing it, kind of putting full-time effort into it. So it's been good. It's been a learning thing, that's for sure. But for sure. It's been fun to see kind of the podcast morph through time, and kind of as my interests change and as things change, like just kind of how it I don't know if maybe matures is the right word for it or not, but how it changes, I guess.
Yeah, that's a fact, man. And the whole podcast game as a whole too, I think, because when I first started, And when did you start?
It would have been my first episode went out July 1st of 2018.
Okay. All right. So around that time, I started in 2014 and then somewhere around 2014, 2015 and 2018, that was when I would call the ramp up. Like everybody at the time started putting out a podcast, and for about, I don't know about you, but I would say maybe 3 years, in that time frame, maybe four, it was just everything. I mean, everybody was coming out with a new podcast, and some of those podcasts, no offense to anybody who's takes this the wrong way, but they just really sucked. And so it's cool to see who lasted. And also, because in my opinion, I feel like there has been some kind of bubble pop in the podcast game. And then out of that pop has come a whole bunch of really refined, high quality content.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. And it is funny when you look back at that time period, I felt like, about the time. So I had the idea for the podcast about a year and a half before I actually did it. I was just too nervous, didn't know, you know, how to do it, if, you know, if anybody would ever listen or how, if I could get guests on, you know, that whole thing. And then I felt like when I did it, I felt like I was too late. Like I felt like there was so many others out there at the time, but I don't know. The way I look at anything is like, if you just do something long enough and you just continually kind of refine it and get better at it, that you're not going to fail. And I mean, it's, you know, there's a handful of us that have definitely lasted the test of time, at least for now.
Yeah. Until there's some major algorithm change or social media bans all hunters, you know what I mean? So, you know, you made a really good point there. And a lot of that carries over into deer hunting and this trial by fire, basically, where you just don't, you're not successful in business and you're not successful as a podcast host in just a 6 month time frame. You're not successful as a hunter if you're just 1 year into it. I mean, there's so much to learn, and so like the carryover between business and hunting, and you know what is relevant and what is, you know, what works, and it's hard work and dedication to a thing will make you better at that thing.
Yeah, no, that, I mean, you're exactly right. And I look at that with anything, because I'm never good at really anything that I start out doing.
Like, that's
it takes
a fact.
Me a lot of time. It takes
Same
me
here.
A lot of time. And I don't know. I just feel like that the more time you put into something, like you'll eventually get a return if you don't quit at it. And it doesn't mean like you should do the same thing and not learn from it over and over again. Maybe you might not get the results you want, but if you just, you know, just it, but it takes throwing yourself into it. And I think like I've always been someone that struggled a little bit in the past of like, and I still do sometimes, where I overanalyze something. And if I do too much research on something, I typically won't do it. But if I can get just enough to get me going and kind of run with it, then I'll just kind of figure things out as I go, which could sometimes, as I'm sure you've run into this too, it's like you get into to problems you didn't anticipate. And it takes a lot to figure out, but I feel like you come out better on the other side. And I think it's the same exact way with hunting. Like when I started, you know, hunting out west, you and I have talked about that before, and I just kind of threw myself into the middle of it. I'm still learning that. Like that's going to be a lifelong learning lesson, and I'm just trying to, you know, go to new places and hunt different places and experience it. And all of it, I kind of look at any new thing I go to do is like at least 3 year plan. Like it's gonna, I look at that for even hunting locally in Pennsylvania. If I go to a new area that I've never been in, it's going to take me about 3 years to have a good handle on that spot. That's how I look at it.
Right. Yeah. I'm the same way, but probably even closer to I am not with all things, but I am the throw the instructions away with the box and learn it the hard way. And that's kind of a bonehead move for me, but that short-term pain I feel is worth the flattening of any learning curve. And success, and for me anyway, comes sooner if I do it in a way where I go in to something not knowing anything, and then I'm learning, I'm like, this sucks, but here I learned today. I learned this with podcasting. I learned, you know, this and this today, and here's a failure. Oh, then, you know, the next week I had to overcome this little thing. And then over the course of a 5 week period, 5 month period, you're just like clicking it. And so that's for me, whenever I started to find out about, and I'd love to hear your opinion on this. Do you listen or read a lot of other hunting how-to type content?
No, I don't.
Yeah. And that's the same with me. I just can't do it. And I don't want to be influenced by anything.
That's exactly what I was going to say is like, I don't want to be influenced and changed, because I've done that. Yeah. I've went down that road where, like, I remember when it was probably 6 years ago when it was like the mobile hunting craze, like, really kind of took off. Yeah. And I started like, holy cow, I need to rethink what I'm doing, because it was like, I need to hunt a different tree every single time. Like, I need to be bouncing around. First time's the best time.
Right.
And, you know, there's some truth that can be pulled from that. But when you're looking at your specific area, that might change. And like, for me, I'm hunting mostly big woods type stuff and low deer densities. You bounce around all the time. You might not ever see a deer where you gotta sit in the same spot over again. That was just an example of like where me taking in media of how to's didn't really help me on that front.
Right.
Now, I think that the information, there's plenty of really, really good information out there. It's just, I try to not influence myself too much with it. And then also, as someone that creates that stuff, I don't want to be influenced on how the way I'm doing something based off of seeing somebody else do it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Hey, man, that also carries over to podcasting too. So like, I don't even listen to a lot of outdoor podcasts, and I own a freaking network, because I want to say everything that I'm doing is authentic to me and my decision-making, not listening to, you know, three or four outdoor podcasts and going, hey, I want to talk to this guy about this same thing that this guy did. And then the next thing you know is it's inevitable in our space, but we have all of these people talking to the same people, talking about the same things of the same time of year. And it's just like, outdoor podcast, and I am guilty of it too, is beating a dead horse. Just like, oh, it's postseason scouting time. Let's talk about it, you know?
Yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, I know. It's actually funny. I was doing a podcast with a friend of mine, Troy Pottinger, about a month or so ago. And I didn't even realize, because I do listen to some hunting podcasts on occasion, but not a lot. I listen to a lot of podcasts, but most of them are different. They're business related, or they're just something completely different than hunting. Yeah. And I didn't realize that Troy had been on with a friend of, I think it's a mutual friend of ours, Aaron Blaise of the Fall.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Podcast. And he was just on it. And Troy said something to me before. He's like, did you listen to the one I did with Aaron? And I was like, no, I didn't. I didn't even know that was the case. And I was like, but I go, even if I did know, I probably wouldn't have had him on at around the same time, yeah. But I don't like listening to it, so it doesn't influence me to like subconsciously like take the conversation the same way that he would have, you know, that sort of speak. So I try to do it where it's like coming from my own mind and asking questions and talking about it, versus, because it's inevitable when you hear something, even if you don't mean to, you start picking up on things, or maybe it kind of changes how you ask questions. That's at least the way it is for me.
All right. So you've talked to a lot of people. I've talked to a lot of people. Let's try to find some similarities from some of the biggest killers or the guys who have consistent success every single year. What is a theme that you run into with these guys who are going out and getting the job done every year?
It doesn't matter how much time they have, they go into the last second that they have available.
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge theme that I see, is like the guys that are successful every single year, it's not that they're always just getting it done on the first or second time out there. They might not always be the absolute most efficient hunter in the woods, except for Andy May. But other than him, they don't quit. They go until they can. And I think that's definitely the top trend that I see amongst all of them. What about on your side? What do you see?
Yeah, I mean, I saw scrolling through social media or something, I saw this Michael Jordan and all the championships that he won. And then it listed the years that he did not win championships. And so there was this time frame before, you know, Michael Jordan was the greatest basketball player of all time, where he did not win any of these championships. And so I look at that and I go, what happened was he had all this experience that led to him being the greatest. You know, obviously there's other things that go into it, but he learned in that period of time, just like the Andy Mays of the world, just like, the Dan Infaults of the world. They go out there and some of these guys went through spells where they had to learn to get to this point. And they've learned, like just exactly what you said, that they hunt every single opportunity that they get, you know, before the season ends to get the job done. And sometimes that's a late season hunt. Sometimes that's October 1st. Sometimes that's grinding it out the whole rut, but they're versatile. So,
yeah.
But outside of that, one thing that I've noticed on these people is the people who go out and get the job done consistently are also guys who, they don't have any other hobbies, man. They may have a whole house full of kids and married in a busy lifestyle, but they're not doing softball tournaments. They're not going to the bars. They've made hunting a priority for themselves. And, you know, their priority is usually family and then hunting, just like what most people are. And then they don't really do anything else. Like some guys fish when you can't hunt, but they're outdoorsmen and they've learned an area, they've become efficient in that area, and then they just rely on past experience to go in and their time. And it kind of comes back to what you said, that their time is efficiently geared towards hunting or bow hunting, you know, specifically. So that's the other thing. Anything else that you can think of that you would see as a theme or a trend?
I just wanted to add to that a little bit of, yeah, and it's like, I've learned that even about myself, like the years, if I try to spread myself too thin to like, say if I'm like trying to, I want to go hunt here, I want to do this, and I start doing too many new things, I don't do as well at the thing that I've, you know, spent all this time like learning how to do efficiently. Right. And like for myself, I've learned that like if I want to be successful in hunting, that I can't be one of these guys that jumps around to a bunch of different states, right, does all this stuff. Like for me, I want to learn specific areas. Like on the whitetail side, Pennsylvania is where I grew up, and that's like what I love to do. But I know it's gonna take me a long time, no matter if I've been doing it since I was, you know, 12 years old till now. It doesn't matter. Every year is different. I need to put in a lot of time. And recently I've been trying to learn West Virginia. And that's been, you know, I'm going on, this will be year three that I'm going into there and trying to learn it and like really put time in there versus like, oh, going here and there. Now, I always like to do at least one like adventure type trip that's completely different a year. But
like out west?
I think like, yeah, like out west. Yeah, okay. But if I want to be like good at doing something, that I know I need to put the time into it. And I noticed that with my guests, like is the same type of thing. You know, I'll have people that are, you know, quote unquote experts in their area or their field or their specific, and that's what they focus on. They're doing right. that all the time. And I just wanted to add to that. I definitely see that as a trend. But the other thing is also they're detail oriented.
That's an excellent point, man. Excellent.
I see them in most, not all. I've seen some that are kind of disorganized that just put in a ridiculous amount of time and figure it out. But I think the majority are very detail oriented in one way or another. Some of that might be with some of it might just be with their gear and having everything dialed and the way they're set up, and they're efficient when they go in the woods. They're not banging things around because they know where everything's at. They can get up a tree quickly. They know where everything's positioned. So if they have no headlamp on, they can do that in the dark.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, other people that, you know, that are really detail oriented with their access and kind of their plans and their scouting, all of those things. I just feel like detail oriented people tend to be some of the ones that I'm talking to the most that are inevitably successful.
Yeah. And really that the more you prepare, I've found the more you prepare, the more you are successful. And the more your head is in the game, and even as, so I don't know about you, but I got my cell phone and I have, you know, Hunt Stand and other apps that allow me to e-scout all the time. And I'm out there, even on properties that I have like 10 years of experience on, I'm in there. I'm just going, okay, you know, hypothetically, what if the wind's doing this? And it allows me to get my head in the game all year round. And so when it's time to hunt, I'm not having to think about access routes. I've already thought about it the last 6 months. You know what I mean? Or what to do if I need to get into a location and the wind is not the ideal wind, but I still need to get into that location.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And I feel like that was something that I've also learned because I love scouting. I love walking new areas. And there's, you know, I always put a goal every spring to do 200 miles on the boots of covering ground and checking areas. Well, for a while, it was like I was covering just new areas. And I learned that to become better during the season, my time's better spent picking like 3 or 4 areas and really walking them multiple times and picking trees, you know, picking trees, say, in the spring. I'm going through and I'm marking like, okay, that tree would be good. This is how I would need to do it. Sometimes I'll even carry my sticks and everything and go in and climb the tree to make sure I can when the season would come. And so I try to plan out all those things ahead of time and spend that time in it. And another thing that's helped me is, and I can look at all these things, I can look at maps and e-scout at home all the time and mark spots, but my brain is only so big and I can forget information when you get into the heart of the season. And you start, say you've been hunting, it's your rut week, and you've hunted, say you have 10 days to hunt and you're on day 7, and you're like, you feel like you have, and you're not having any success, and you're like, man, I don't know what to do. Like you feel lost where in your head, where you really have, you have multiple spots. You have so many spots that you could go to, but you kind of get scatterbrained. So for me, it helps to write that stuff down or type it up as I do, and like have lists of like on certain winds, what places work, so that I can make it a very easy approach. Like, okay, if I'm feeling lost, I can look at what I call my hunt plan and be like, okay, here's 3 options. Pick one of them and go to it. And, you know, you already have the access figured out. You have all those things, and just go to it and make it more so you don't get paralysis by analysis and start, you know, freaking yourself out.
Yeah. So I'm going through something similar to what you're doing out there in West Virginia, right? So I'm heading west, and I'm trying to figure out some mule deer out in South Dakota and Nebraska, and I've been out there multiple years now. How long does it take you, and how many seasons of going to the same place and trying to figure out deer movement does it take you before you start to feel confident and going into a place saying, hey, I know I need to be at this pinch point, or I need to be, you know, on this ridge, or I know that there's an acorn tree here and it usually is going to have a doe group come feed under it. How long does that usually take you to get confident with a farm or a spot?
I think it's 3 years for me. Yeah. I think it takes at least 3 years to really get you know, under me, because I always look at the first year as kind of like a test thing, you know, whether it's with cameras or hunting. Like, I have some kind of test things that are in my head that I think would work out. And sometimes, like, I won't even hunt an area the first year. I might just drop cameras in places as far as, like, kind of and just let them soak and kind of get me a head start on year two. Maybe that year one I'm hunting a place that I already know. And then all of a sudden I go in and it's like, okay, now I start breaking it down more and walking more of the land, or like, you know, where you start, I guess, to go back, like, say you're looking at a big area and you start by hitting these priority areas on the map that you marked and you're checking them. And then as you go after year one, whether you hunted it or trail camera data, you start finding areas that are hotter than other areas. And now I might try to break down those smaller areas in more detail. And then that takes me to the next step in figuring that out. And like, so going back to West Virginia, the first year I was down there, I was hunting with a friend of mine that has hunted there his whole life. So like, I had that reduced the learning curve a lot. And I had a shot opportunity there during that first time that I was there. But the second year I went in, which was this past year, I was all on my own and going in and trying to figure it out. And, you know, I had these inclinations, but I still didn't have like the full confidence in myself of some of these spots. And some of them were like, they proved like, man, if I would have just sat there, like I thought, that it would have worked out. And then there was other places that were complete bust that I thought, you know, that I would have thought would have been good. And I started learning, you know, the second year I started finding patches of white oak trees that I didn't know, you know, were there. I started to see how deer were using a different type of cover that I wasn't used to, you know, with these old coal mines. A lot of autumn olive bushes are grown through and super thick and nasty all through these spots. And I'm like, I wonder how they're using this. And now this past year, I started seeing trends on how they were working the terrain and using this stuff. So now as I go, I'm going to go back down there in the next month or so and scout it again. I have a better plan of how to go. And I'm actually going to go through and kind of prep trees and look at things and try to figure out how to, you know, when it comes into this fall, you know, have a better game plan going into it, at least more confidence in it.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you are, and I know this is a tricky question because every place a person hunts is different, right? Big woods, you know, then we have Iowa, which is like a 50-50 ag state. And then we have, you know, whitetails live everywhere, right? And so the question that I have for you is there a, when you're out and you're scouting and you're looking at, you know, this West Virginia piece, what are you looking for that you've looked for in the past from other properties that says, okay, I have a spot like this at this farm, like basically similar things in a new property. What's that look like for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. And for me, I always, when I'm looking at like e-scouting and I'm trying to figure out an area, I'm always looking first is vegetation diversity. Yeah. So I'm trying to find where there's like, if I'm looking at a map, that there's different types of trees or habitat that, you know, whether it might be open areas that are grassy fields, or if it was like an ag country, different ag stuff. And then, you know, conifer trees mixed in with mast trees and like all of those different things. I want to find the most diversity that I possibly can. And that's something that I've found in all the different places that I've been to, that is definitely something that correlates. And then also, then I look at terrain and things that a lot of the areas that I've hunted historically have had different terrain and elevation changes throughout. So I'll see patterns of certain terrain features that deer like to move on. And the steeper it is, to be honest, it's easier as far as how those terrain features are being used, is because it's really pinching deer down, almost like a fence row would in ag country. Like I look at things that way. So really, it's like I take those main things, looking for vegetation diversity and specific terrain features, and then trying to understand whatever that new area that I'm going to, how much do I think that weighs in on that specific area based off of the conditions that are presented?
It's so crazy because, to me, that made sense, right? But you got a guy who is new, and I want you to say the same thing now, but I want you to say it to someone who is in year one of trying to figure out a new property, or year one of bow hunting, period. Like, so give me the translation, dumb it down.
Yes. Okay. So what I'm looking for is, when I'm looking at a map, I just want to see, to really like simplify it, it's like, I want to see different colors on that map that show that there's like a patch of something that may be dark colored on the map. If you're looking at an aerial map, that's showing like, okay, that's probably some sort of a conifer tree, whether it's a pine thicket, a hemlock stand, or something along those lines. And then maybe you can see an area that's really like light green and almost looks like a field, but you can kind of see trees. That might be a logging cut that would be a food source. It'd probably be bedding. It has a lot of different stuff associated with it when you're looking at big wood settings. And then open areas, grassy openings, or whatever that might be, those are important in a couple different reasons. They can offer as a food source in the late season if it's still green, or they might be munching on things there. But it also means that these bucks don't want to walk through the middle of that open spot. So it kind of just like, it helps you figure out how the deer are going to move around those places. But I like where multiple things meet at one point. So the different colors on the map there. And then this is where I turn on the topography side of the layers. I turn that on and I try to see where, say, an example of a pinch or something that I look at from a topography standpoint would be a bench on the side of a hill. So a flat spot on the side of the hill where the topography lines are wider. And it might be, you see a bunch of topography lines that are close together, meaning it's really steep on one spot. And then above that, you might see the same thing. And then a flat spot in between. Yeah. It's like, okay, there's a more likely chance deer are going to travel through there. And now, where does that coincide with, where can I find where that coincides with vegetation edges?
Yeah.
And that's giving me a really good starting point to go in and check those areas out. Now, a lot of that is associated with rut type movement. But that gives me starting points when I go in and I scout and look at those places. And now I might start finding like, okay, there's oak trees here and there's a really nice point of a ridge that goes out, and that would probably offer some good bedding for those bucks. So I'll check that out. And then you start putting pieces of the puzzle together. Like, how would they be traveling to this? Why would they feel safe bedding in these locations and go? And for somewhere that has a lot of terrain, like Southern West Virginia, where I hunt, is extremely steep. It's big country. Those topography features where a lot of them meet are so important. What is called a topo hub. So basically you'll have, say, three or more ridges that meet at one point. So it's so steep there that these bucks run up and down the points and then up over the tops of the ridges, and they might run some side hill stuff going through, but for the most part, they're trying to find anywhere that's even relatively flat to go. So where you can find where multiple places meet at one point, that's an odds multiplier for finding movement or sign. Or you might find typically I'll find a big scrape there. It's a good spot to throw a camera and start, dissecting that area a little bit.
So once you've found one of these locations, right, is there usually sign there, maybe old scrapes or old rubs from previous years in these areas that you've mentioned?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Typically when you find those travel kind of areas like that, where there's a lot that's meeting at one point, there's some sort of communication tool there, whether it's a signpost rub or a community scrape that's just, you could see has been used for years. And if I find that stuff that's like, you see a scrape tree that has 5, 6, 7 licking branches, some are old and not even being used anymore, but that's like, for me, that's a green light. Like, man, this has been historically a good spot.
Yeah. And then does that ring true then when you're looking at your maps And then you say, okay, well, I know for a fact, because I've had boots on the ground in this location. It has rubs, it has scrapes, it has activity. Maybe you've even hunted it before. How confident are you then that if you find another location similar to that, using, you know, e-scouting or maps or whatever, that same activity, not necessarily activity, but the same sign, yeah, we'll just say activity, is there at that spot as well?
Yeah, that you're 100% right. And that's what I use, is like those trends and finding things. And sometimes it takes a while. And like we were talking about, you know, me saying it takes at least 3 years for me to really figure out an area, because each of those things are going to change a little bit. Like, you know, what's the best type of sign or what you're going to find. And sign looks different in different places too. Yeah. You know, there's some areas that'll be littered with sign, and sign that you thought looked like great sign in one spot, if there's 100 of those places in one area, then that's might not be as good. Or if you go to an area where that's like the only thing that looks like that. So yeah. I try to take it, and it's all relative to each area, but you find that for me, at least, by just walking around a ton and trying to get a gauge on how things are looking. But there's a lot of trends that you'll find in these places that you can look at a map, and it starts to make your e-scouting easier as you start applying it to different places.
Yeah. How important is understanding topography? And what I mean by that is looking at topo lines and being able to read what that says.
I think it's critical to be able to do that. Cause I think no matter where you go, even in areas that are relatively flat, topography can teach you things. Like there's some areas of big woods that I hunt that's pretty flat with some swamps in it and some things there that I've learned that even little topography changes can mean, you know, if there's a little rise that might be in a swamp and you have, you know, your contour intervals, which I'll explain this in a second, but your contour intervals as small as you possibly can, say like 10-foot intervals, you can start to see these little spots that are, you know, better for deer to bed, or a low lying area that's running into a clear cut that might be across this giant flat top, but those deer are more likely to go in that low lying area, kind of like a field, versus, you know, just walking into it randomly. And so I think topography, no matter where you're at, is important to be able to read. And I think it kind of can help you almost map out potential deer trails without even stepping foot in there.
Yeah. Yeah. More truer words have never been spoken, man. I mean, I could, before I was using topo lines, I would just use satellite imagery. And then I would go to my farm and I'd say, you know, man, why are the deer, like from where I was at, I could see into the field. Why are they all in this one spot in this field or this pasture or whatever? And then you drive out and you can't see that from the road or whatever, or you can't see it from certain points of, you know, if I wasn't in a tree stand, I probably wouldn't have been able to see them. And it's only just like a 2 or 3 foot difference, but you know, deer can disappear and all that stuff. It wasn't until I pulled up topo lines and like what you said, changed the intervals to the smallest, to the smallest interval, where I could start seeing why deer move in certain areas or why they move. And it is 100% because they don't want to skyline themselves. Now, I'm not saying that holds true everywhere, but they are always taking some kind of path. Even if humans can't understand it, they're taking a certain path for a really good reason. And whether that is some kind of scent hub I've found where they can smell 3 or 4 different drainages all from one point, or it's to stay low and out of sight to get to a food source or you know, whatever. There's so many different options there, but man, it really hasn't been too long ago. I would say like maybe 5 years only that I've really have dove into topography. And man, it is, once there's a couple aha moments there for sure, I think anyway.
Yeah. And I think too, like, now that e-scouting tools are getting better with 3D imagery and all this stuff, like, I think all that stuff's helpful, but I think it's still so important to understand basic topo maps and understand how that works, because I don't know, I just see so many benefits with being able to read a map and be able to understand, you know, thinking about how the deer are going to move through that. And like you said, with, you know, the fields, and I was actually going to turn that question back on you, and you kind of answered it. But as far as, like, I don't have as much experience in, like, hunting some of the agricultural lands that you do. And do you find, I mean, you gave one example there, but do you find that still just holding true?
Well, here's a perfect example. I'm sure that you've seen in your scenarios in Big Woods, is there's always a main ridge, right? That is very noticeable. But on the sides of these main ridges, if your topo lines are too far apart, you won't be able to see them. But if you go to the lowest, you know what I mean? The lines
contour
are
clear. Interval.
Yep. Contour interval. You're starting to see these subtle other little small ridges on the sides. And I call those spur ridges, right? So a spur ridge on the side of it. And from my experience, now I wouldn't say I hunt big woods, but I have a couple farms that are all timber, right? And they're big drainages that go down to a river bottom and then back up. And so they run on these very subtle depressions on the side of the ridge, almost like if someone was going to build a set of stairs up the side, it wouldn't go straight up. It kind of is horizontal with the ridge, but kind of works its way up to the point. And so on these ridges, one thing that I've found is that if you can find them on the topo lines and you can get a tree stand somewhere in towards the top of where that subtle depression hits the top of the ridge, you can really use thermals and cut the wind really hard as they curve up to an area, and you can get away with absolute murder in those spots, man. I mean, they're just, I don't, just talking about it brings me back to several tree stand locations that I have, and the topo lines tell the story. And so the closer the topo line, the better story that it tells. And if, you know, on some of these satellite imageries, there's some shading that can get thrown into it, and you can really see it, and it really pops out. And so, I don't know, I get fired up about things like that.
Yeah. Oh, man. And the same thing too, like, I know of some spots that I have, like, you hear the term thermal hub kind of thrown around, where it's, you know, a low-lying area where you got multiple ridges that kind of run down to it, and it creates a, you know, toilet bowl effect with winds. It's hard, but the deer love it because of that. They can smell everything. There's always good sign there, and they can be difficult to hunt. But once you start learning how the topography and how thermals and stuff work, you can figure out how to hunt some of these spots, depending on the wind speed and everything, without going geeking out really hard on that. It's like, when you learn how that works, you can use things like streams, like small creeks. Like, I'll hunt right on the bank of those in those areas, because if it's a low wind speed day, my thermals are going to pull down that stream, even though out in front of me where I might be shooting, might be swirling and doing all these things, right where my tree's at. And that the last two bucks I shot in Pennsylvania were that exact scenario, and that I was able to sit basically right on that stream bank, and my thermals pull down. You walk 10 yards in front of my stand and throw milkweed out, and it's going to go a completely different direction than where it does at that tree.
Yeah. I got a spot on a creek where on a north wind, it's not necessarily the water that causes it. I think it's just all of a sudden the wind is blowing on when I hunted on a north wind, and maybe even a little northwest. But what happens is there's no trees growing in this area. And so on the banks, there's all these trees, and they all kind of curve up, and they create a literal tunnel. And so when the wind blows through this bedding area to the west and to the east, it all catches in this tunnel, and it just then sucks everything down, right? And so I can drop my milkweed and it just floats forever. And when it's consistent, even if it's a little stiff wind, I mean, it's going over the back of all these deer. And so the only thing I have to worry about is just getting into the stand. And I usually kick up a couple deer going into the stand, but once I'm in it, a lot tight. And then the same stand on a south wind, the wind is blowing right at me, but it hits the bank of the river bank or the creek bank, and it causes a draft up. I wouldn't call it a thermal. If it's a warm day, it helps, but it just goes straight up, hits the bank, goes straight up. I'm in that draft, and when I drop my milkweed, it just goes straight up. Almost on a south wind, almost all times a day, even in a cool, I would say, even in a cool spot where, you know, thermals are usually pulled down. So it's a pretty sweet spot. And, man, I've gotten close to a lot of really good deer in that little spot.
Oh, that gets me. Yeah. That gets me fired up hearing about spots like that. When you find, like, I call them bulletproof spots.
Yeah.
You find a spot that, like, you feel like you're invincible from the wind standpoint. Like, that's our biggest enemy when we're in a tree, at least for me. And I'm like, man, I just feel confident at that point.
You know, it wasn't until right now, us geeking out about these spots, that I now understand nerds a little bit better. Because although I don't, I wouldn't call myself a nerd, I nerd out about things like this. And so when like you hear someone talk about, well, Lord of the Rings, episode one, or, you know, whatever, yeah. or something that is real nerdy, I go, I now understand, because they have this passion for this thing. And then most of my friends, none of them really hunt. And so it's like whenever I start talking about, so why did you hunt in this spot? Well, here, let me tell you. And then in 5 minutes into it, they're just like, that was a dumb question. I should have never asked it, because you just went way overboard with everything you did. So, so topo lines, thermals, all the other, what's another topic that you nerd out about?
I nerd out about scrapes, and I excuse me, I'm losing my words here, but I nerd out about scrapes and how deer are using them in specific places. Like, there's some scrapes that I'll find that are just worked year round, not necessarily pawing the ground, but the licking branches and understanding how they use that as a communication tool.
Yeah.
And so, like, for me, I love finding scrapes that I find deer are using outside of the typical pre-rut time frame.
Yeah.
And I enjoy trying to figure out why that location of the scrape or the specific type of tree, what makes them do that. And every year or so I run quite a few cameras, and I run at least 50 of them now, through different areas. And I run a lot of test cameras of, like, Bo has a theory that pops into his head, or he sees something that maybe completely off the wall, and I just toss the camera there and let it sit all year just to figure out how deer are using it. And I've found trends, like, with scrapes of, like, okay, say you find one in, like, a big topo funnel, like I was talking about, where you have a bunch of ridges that meet at one point. That's pretty standard. But now it's like, okay, as you're out scouting and you find a big scrape, and it's like, okay, trying to figure out, what time of year do you think these deer are using it? And, like, even before running cameras on, I start seeing trends of, like, okay, if I find areas that have a bunch of, now we're going back to the vegetation diversity standpoint. So, for example, for us, logging cuts are a big deal, because those are kind of like the food plots of the big woods. And and if you get one that's in, like, a 3 to 8 year old range, they have enough browse that, like, you know, the trees are, you know, just over their back as far as being tall, and they're able to browse on a bunch of stuff. There's a bunch of briars in there they're nibbling on, but it's also thick enough for them to bed. So it's like, wherever deer are spending their most time, like, those scrapes that are around those areas typically are better outside of other times of year. And also, like, those places, the even when there's not as much, when the leaves drop off the trees, it's still cover.
Yeah.
Like there's some places I'll find that I'll call them early season scrapes, that when the woods are all green and there's a lot more thick cover and a lot more bedding around, but as soon as the leaves drop off, that spot is completely ghost town.
Yeah.
And so it's fun for me to kind of geek out on that.
Yeah.
And try to figure out how they use communication to work through the woods.
Man, I tell you this, I've tried to be that guy who finds an active or finds a fresh scrape and sit over it, but more times than not, it doesn't lead to anything for me. And so like, I may move into an area because of like, let's say I'm doing some in-season scouting or I'm going in to check a trail camera somewhere. And all of a sudden all these big rubs and these scrapes pop up. And what typically happens is I don't care about where they actually are. It just tells me deer are in here moving around. So then I go to my next step, and that is to locate the best terrain feature in the area. And so I'll identify the area as being good by the sign that I find, and then move in to, I don't know, like a staging area. Or maybe a spur ridge like we talked about. And usually some of those places kind of coincide. Like sometimes there's a scrape at the bottom or at the top of a spur ridge, or maybe there's some small rubs that are in that path as well. But usually, man, I don't know why, but I just don't get geeked out about scrapes and rubs. I understand the purpose of them, but like for me, when it comes to the strategy, I don't make a ton of decisions based off that.
That's interesting, and I just know that like in the big woods, it just seems like those are key things. But I will say what you said there is something that I use in areas that have high hunting pressure, where those things jump out of people. For example, saddles. So you know, low spot between two higher points in a ridge, deer travel through there. It's no secret. It's been talked about for a ton of years. Well, in a lot of places I hunt, there will be a tree stand or two in the center of that saddle. And there's always a big scrape there. I mean, it's always like a big, it's a great spot to run a trail camera if you're not worried about it getting stolen and having them in that spot. But what I do is like when I find a place like that, now I start like looking out. I might look at a map or walk it and like, okay, where are they coming from to go here? Like, where are they going? And it might be 300-400 yards away. Going out around that point on the side of a hill, there's a spot that there's a small bench and maybe some mountain laurel that makes it, you know, thicker, gives some cover, that's associated, or green briar that gives some cover there. And now maybe I might set up there where there's no real sign. There might not be a scrape, there might not be any rubs, but it's like a micro feature that they're more apt to go through during daylight versus that spot, that big, you know, where everybody else can read that sign and see it too. So mostly the time when I'm not hunting directly over it, it has to do with a hunting pressure standpoint. Or I've also come to learn that a lot of the older deer won't always just hit the scrape or walk on those flat benches. They'll walk just over the edge. It might not be that far away. It might only be 10, 15 yards. And sometimes it might be 80 yards away, but I look for those faint trails that kind of go off the side over one of those terrain features close to there that I might set up on while still playing off of that scrape.
Yeah, I got it. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we kind of talked a little bit about everything, and we also kind of talked about nothing really today. And so, I mean, I love the scouting talk, cause it's really relevant for this time of year, man. I can't wait. Man, February is a busy month for me, but as soon as I think it's like the last week in February, I'm putting my boots on and I'm going to start making some moves and really kind of even walking through some of the properties that I'm really familiar with, because just like you, the big woods, man, it can, one tree can fall down and then in the next year, it's just five times thicker in that area. Right. And so it changes so much that I felt like I've been neglecting some of these farms and kind of just going to old reliable spots every time. And so I don't know about you, but I'm looking forward to this spring and putting on some miles, man.
Yeah, same. And I do want to add a point to kind of like bring this full circle. Like,
yeah,
when we're talking about e-scouting earlier and going through that for new areas and going into it, well, sometimes I do the same thing where there's areas that I've been hunting for 7-8 years now that I start becoming lackadaisical on, like, yeah. I just know historical sign. And then sometimes I'll go do that and hunt that and not have the same success I did in the past and wonder why. It's like, oh, I didn't realize they logged over here. You know,
yeah,
that completely changed it. Now they're feeding over here, or maybe there was one thing that's been hitting Pennsylvania is the gypsy moss and killing a lot of the oak trees, or just killing the acorn crops for the year. So it's like, yeah, that changes everything. And there's a lot of things that can be changed for it. So I was talking about this with Tony Peterson a few months ago. We were talking about how when you start becoming patternable yourself on like how you walk through an area or even going to check trail cams or doing anything. And so I try to, in the spring, like do something different, even if it's, yeah, an area that I've been in so many times, maybe parking my truck at a different spot or accessing and just walking through a different area to look at it from a different set of eyes and be able to figure it out from that front. And then looking at maps again, I think that's so crucial as far as like going back, even though you know that and you've probably walked every square inch at one point of that property, the more experiences you have by hunting there, the more you learn. And when you go back and look at a map, sometimes all of a sudden something will jump out at you like, man, you're an idiot. How did you not know that before? Because of an experience.
Right.
And it just helps you put those pieces of the puzzle together. So that's where I'm in the process of now. This spring is like, okay, I have like three areas that I definitely know I'm going to focus on again that I've been in for years. But then I'm going to have 2 to 3 others that I'd kind of just go out and start playing with. And
yeah,
I just love walking new places.
Yeah.
Like that's like my favorite thing to be able to do.
Yeah. I miss that, man.
Productive.
Do you have any kids?
I don't.
Okay. Well, I'm saying maybe have some kids, but don't have three of them. Okay. Because right now, my scouting missions are going to have to be like, get in my car, haul ass somewhere, scout for like 20 minutes and then come back home. That's about what I feel I have for free time these days.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's definitely situational,
right,
as far as where you're at in life and everything when you can do it. And it's funny because when I started this podcast and doing this, it's like, and even when I went full time with it, I was like, man, I'm going to have so much more time. Well, when you're working for yourself, as you know, Dan, you're actually busier than ever because like, you know, if you're working a regular job, you can be lazy some days and it's not going to like penalize you completely. But if you're not working all the time and doing other things, and although that like my work surrounds the hunting type space and hunting content, someone's got to be there actually doing the work and putting it out, because if there's not stuff going out, then you're not generating anything from it. And so I have less time than I did before, and that's even without kids. So
yeah,
that to the mix, I can imagine that it's a very strategic approach to your scouting.
It's almost as detailed of a strategy as we talked about today. Talking, geeking out about, thermals and topo lines. That's how detailed I have to be to get free time to go do some of these things. Like, I can remember back in the day when I was going to check trail cameras. Now I check trail cameras like 3 times a year. That's it. Right. And so I drop them in the summer, I check them once before the season starts, and then I'll check them probably in March, late February or March again. And so, yikes.
Yeah.
Busy.
Yeah.
Busy life.
I hear you, man. Well, that's cool. And I think a lot of people can relate to that from the standpoint of only having so much time. And like, I just talked about goals of 200 miles on boots and all these things. Like, that's, everything's got to be toned down to what you have available.
Absolutely.
And being able to do that. And I think that I don't need to go hike 200 miles every spring. I just like going to do that. And I can do that I am able to do that. So that's one thing. Now, if you might condense that down to two or three farms or two or three spots, and you can do that in a couple weekends of being able to go out or after work type of deal. So it's all relative, and just the same thing with sign and different areas. Everything's just like you tone it to what you have available.
Absolutely, man. Hey, Bo, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on today, and good luck scouting in the upcoming weeks, and hopefully that all leads to another big woods monster this upcoming season, man.
Well, I appreciate it, Dan. Thanks for having me on. We'll be right back.